Her academic life in the EM blog is bigger than an untreated hernia in an 80-year-old obese man.
Ouch.
Her team is smarter than the genetic crossbreeding of Dr. Spock and Stephen Hawking.
Yeah, baby.
She drops more pearls than a new Tiffany attendant. It's Michelle Lin and the Lin Sessions.
Hello, hello, everyone. And I wanted to kick off today's segment talking about ethics at the bedside. And no, wait, don't hit the fast forward button. I promise you, you won't regret it. We're going to boil it down to some practical relevance on your next ED shift, thanks to our star guest, Dr. Jill Barron. Woo! She's a professor of emergency medicine, pediatrics, and wait for it. What?
What?
Medical ethics.
Medical ethics.
At the University of Pennsylvania. And that, my friends, is the trifecta, the hat trick in academia. So welcome to the podcast, Jill.
Thanks, Michelle. It's great to be here.
Well, hey, I got a question for you. How did you get interested in the study of ethics?
Yeah, that seems to be the question everybody has on their mind. Well, in fact, I've always been interested in ethics. It's quite simple because I'm a humanist. I am very drawn to the humanistic aspects of medical care. And it's not that science and research and evidence-based medicine aren't important. In fact, you know, they're terribly important if you aspire to practice safe, high-quality emergency medicine, but they're not sufficient. It's in the art of medicine where you could really excel and make a difference in people's lives. And I think it's one of the antidotes to physician burnout, especially in the emergency department. I think I was kind of aware of this early on in my career in a more subtle way, not so overt. But the longer I practice, the more important it's actually become to me. So I had already established my academic career when I decided to pursue a Master of Bioethics degree. And what this did for me was it gave me an opportunity to really connect with other like-minded physicians, people who were also interested in those humanistic aspects of care. And it also enhanced my teaching by adding another dimension to patient care. Now, you know, Michelle, in clinical medicine, we learn clinical reasoning and we apply it to our patients over and over and over again through a series of cases in order to solve diagnostic dilemmas. Well, we need to do the same thing when it comes to ethical dilemmas. We need to apply an ethical decision-making framework to patient care.
Yes, yes, and yes, that's so true. We focus on teaching and learning the ABCs of critical resuscitations, the XYZs of sepsis care. But it's really in the more nebulous art of medicine and in between spaces where we often make just as much of an impact. So you had me from the beginning. I'm all in. And I'm curious what you have to share with us. But can I actually start with a rather embarrassing question, which is I need help defining what ethics is. And I hopefully am not the only one who's not really clear what it encompasses. Help me out here.
No, you are not the only one. People ask this question a lot because they have a feel for what ethics is, but they don't really know how to define it. So very simply put, ethics is the application of values and moral rules to human activities and behaviors. What we're really aiming for in medicine, as well as in our general lives, is to create good by doing right, which serves as our framework for action. Now, when we talk about the field of bioethics, we use ethical principles to solve actual or anticipated dilemmas in medicine or biology. And we can get even more specific here to what we're talking about, and that is clinical bioethics. Clinical bioethics is that case-based reasoning. It relies on learned rules, so things we do over and over again in clinical practice, and it takes into account prior decisions and recognition of unique factors that we find in each case. And we'll flesh that out a bit more later in our discussion.
Yeah, it sounds like there could be a million different permutations of cases that could weigh on us on a day-to-day basis. But maybe if we could take such a case report and tackle one or two that we commonly may encounter in the ED. And side note, I personally love mental frameworks. They help me unlock my brain when I encounter scenarios which make me just freeze up like a deer in headlights. So maybe we can tackle one or two cases. That'll be great.
You got it.
Case one.
Let's say we've encountered a patient involving DNR status. Ugh, it's making me nauseous just thinking about it. So let's say, for example, you had a skilled nursing facility transport to you a 84-year-old resident with a history of dementia for a quote-unquote change in mental status. So you appropriately begin treatment with intubation, fluids, antibiotics, a lot of diagnostics. But then a few minutes later, a family members arrive. They wave a piece of paper, just furious, stating that You had ignored their mother's wishes to remain DNR. So, gosh, how would you approach such a scenario?
So basically, Michelle, you're saying they come in with an advance directive after the patient had arrived, which we know is such a frequent occurrence in the emergency department. And patients like these, they happen on every single one of our shifts. So I think I'll start off by saying something that I think will resonate with most people. And that is that emergency physicians have a very strong moral imperative to save lives. Now, that's based on the presumption that the patient or their family member would consent to preserve life or health if he or she were able to, and if there was sufficient time. We know in situations like this where a patient comes in extremis, there is not sufficient time to obtain that kind of consent. So we rely on things like advance directives. So should you resuscitate if you're not sure about the existence of an advance directives? Yes, absolutely you should. The motto is, if in doubt, resuscitate. However, this case, I think, brings up for us that there is a competing moral imperative, and that's the moral imperative that emergency physicians have to relieve pain and suffering. So emergency physicians should never overrule a valid advance directives. But in this case, once the family arrives, it's quite ethically permissible to withdraw care once more information is available and the goals of care can be determined. This is the point in time which I think a lot of people shy away from. And I call this the point in time where you switch from cure to care and you begin to manage the dying process rather than just kind of say, all right, I've done my job with intubation and the resuscitation part of it, but now you're really in it with this family and you've really got to be able to manage the dying process. Now, I think everybody should know that ethicists make absolutely no moral distinction between withholding and withdrawing treatment. But conventional wisdom tells us it's a lot harder to withdraw once you've instituted care.
Mm-hmm.
The other important thing to know is that the law does not require any kind of maintenance of life-sustaining therapy. When a treatment is not effective, there's absolutely no moral obligation to continue it. And if you think about it, many prolonged cardiac arrest situations are just that. They're futile and shouldn't be continued. So sometimes these scenarios develop a little twist, such as when family members maybe don't all agree with each other about withdrawing life-sustaining treatment. So in that case, another ethical dilemma, clearly, you can continue to treat while establishing the prognosis, getting more information, or until disputes are resolved. You can stop treatment if you are convinced that that's the decision the patient would make. What's extremely important is to be truthful and to disclose a poor prognosis and know that you are under no obligation to render treatment that is futile. These are really tough concepts for many emergency physicians to grapple with, especially if you're on the younger side of practice, just coming out of training, and also if there was no role modeling of these kinds of conversations or decisions during your training period. These are tough things to learn on the job. So I'm hoping that the listener will feel empowered to exercise this type of ethical decision-making in the ED and not avoid such decisions. So again, no moral distinction between withholding and withdrawing treatment.
Wow, my brain is on fire there. You just presented so much there to unpack, moving from cure to care. That is such a great phrase that helps shift mindsets. And it's interesting that you mentioned that ethicists make no distinction between withholding and withdrawing treatment. Still, it's personally super tough for me to make that shift. Now, you mentioned for such difficult conversations, it's good to see people role model such conversations. And I'm curious, what sort of phrases or do you have any lines that you use or approaches in talking to patients and or their families and withdrawing such care? Such as, like, for instance, in our case, stopping the ventilatory care that you already provided. And perhaps some of the listeners can use these phrases down the road as well when they encounter similar circumstances.
Yeah, a couple of things here, Michelle. First and foremost, I know why people often avoid these kinds of conversations. It's because we're really busy in the ED, and something like this really does require being in the moment with the family. So going into a private space, making sure that you're able to sit down, have eye contact, provide, you know, family members with water, with tissues, and this is obviously such a life-defining moment for them. So it is important to set up the environmental circumstances just right before you have a conversation like this. But when you think about it, it's a resource issue as well. We shouldn't be passing the buck and having ICU physicians or other physicians take care of resolving these issues necessarily, particularly when there is an advanced directive that really does state what a patient's preferences are. So here's the way I like to approach it. I never like to use the phrase, "What would you like us to do?" Because that really implies that it's our system of values and preferences that's more important for the patient, when in fact the opposite is true. I like to say to families, "What do you think your mother or your brother or your father would want us to do in this situation? Are there conversations or phrases or discussions that might have happened between family members that can help point us in the right direction, that can help us learn more about what your family members' values and preferences would have been in this situation if they could speak for themselves?" And that's really what you're trying to do here. You're trying to understand that person through substituted judgment by using members of their family who are close to them, who understand them and can express those things, rather than just using your sort of best interest standard as a physician. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. I love that so much, to reframe the discussion about what the patient would have wanted and not put as much pressure directly on the family's values and judgments, and moving the conversation that way. Well, hey, you got time for another case by chance?
Of course.
Case two.
Well, let's talk about something I just saw like the other day. Let's talk about refusal of care. Let's say you have a 25-year-old man who was involved in some interpersonal violence, undetermined etiology, coming home from a bar, presents with multiple facial lacerations, and he's agitated. He doesn't want any care. He doesn't want you to repair, clean, or anything, do anything with his wounds. He's mildly intoxicated. You can smell some alcohol, but he denies drinking more than one beer. Now, I always believe people when they drink one beer, but it's unclear how large that beer is. So he's alert, he's oriented, and simply states he just wants to leave. And he's not being held in custody by the police, and he's not homicidal, suicidal. And you try to have a discussion with them and mention the possibility that, hey, maybe you can kind of strong arm this guy verbally into staying and say, "Hey, I might need to put on some restraints if you leave." But then he escalates it and threatens to sue you. So this is the stuff that really can ruin my day. And it actually did ruin my day. And so I wanted maybe some advice from your perspective on how do I resolve this case a little bit better in such a difficult patient?
Yeah, well, you use the terminology exactly right. This is a difficult patient. And sadly, having multiple patients like this, and we all have them on every shift, it can really weigh you down. And as I said earlier, it can contribute to burnout in practicing emergency medicine. So in many refusal of care situations, you have to kind of take a step back and realize that patients may be unreasonable, but they're not necessarily irrational. And so you kind of check your own judgment at the door, and you think about what's going to get me out of this situation in the most civil and collegial and professional way possible. That's the way I like to go into a discussion like this. Now, refusal of care is actually the corollary in ethical terms of the right to informed consent. That's when you present a patient with risks, alternative benefits. If you were going to go ahead and do any kind of invasive procedure on a patient, that's the kind of conversation you would be having. If we didn't do that, then we would be subjecting our patients to coercion or even forceful intrusion, and we would be considered very paternalistic in terms of making decisions for them. So the key is to make sure that there's an informed refusal conversation, which should just really mirror a good informed consent conversation with all of the essential components. So, you know, why would you recommend this procedure to the patient? What would happen if the patient didn't have that? What are the risks? What are the benefits? What are the alternatives? As well as a statement indicating to the patient that you would still care for them despite their choices. And I think that's a really important message to communicate.
Oh, I love that.
Now, refusal of care, importantly, Michelle, is formally established in American case law, and it's actually considered part of the right to privacy. It's the prerogative of somebody who's capable. So we all know that treatment without consent is warranted in a life-threatening emergency or when the patient is incapacitated, but it's invalid when a patient demonstrates capacity. Now, I know everybody has learned something about what capacity is and how to determine capacity in patients at some point in their training, whether it be medical school or residency. So if you are going to have an informed refusal conversation with a patient, make sure first that they demonstrate the components of decision-making capacity. And that is knowledge of the options, awareness of the consequences, and appreciation of the personal costs and benefits depending on what decision they make.
So I especially love that point where you mentioned that no matter what happens in terms of the discussion of the refusal of care, I always leave it open to the patient, like, hey, no hard feelings. You can always change your mind. Please come on back. We'll get it fixed up for you. And leaving that open book has saved us so many times, because 6 more hours, sometimes they come back more sober and we're like, oh, I was not making wise life choices. I would like this fixed. And so I love leaving that open so they don't feel like they're just have no options.
And you know, Michelle, one other thing is people always think that the against medical advice form really protects them in situations like this. And I would say that you've got to do a bit of a reality check on that. That's really a starting point to document your conversation. But what's really important in an informed refusal is the conversation itself and not the fact that you've obtained a signature on a piece of paper.
So true. The other thing that resonated with me is that you mentioned about demonstrating that they have good decision-making capacity. And yes, we've always talked about it during training, but I think it's really warrants some re-highlighting again. I just want to repeat, it's 3 components. 1 is being sure that the patient knows their options. 2, they're aware of the consequences. And 3, they appreciate the personal risks and benefits to them.
And you really need to reassure yourself that that patient is reiterating those things to you, all against kind of a backdrop of very stable values and preferences. Where this can get tricky is when a patient is intoxicated or depressed, or if there's something else that's clouding their mental status. So you are right. It is those 3 things, but do a global assessment as well.
Perfect. Well, we went through these 2 cases, and I think are relatively common scenarios that we encounter in the ED. But we all know there are like an infinite number of very unique ethical dilemmas out there determined by individual circumstances. And I'm wondering if you can give us some guidance on how we as emergency physicians and providers can be more comfortable in this area. Are there any general guidelines, rules that we can apply?
Yeah, fortunately there are. And you hit it right on the head when you say there's an infinite number of ethical dilemmas, just like there are an infinite number of diagnostic dilemmas that we encounter. So let's do a bit of a reality check here. And let's face it, decisions in the emergency department are often made with little or no time for reflection or consultation. So thinking about calling a stat consult to the ethics committee simply won't work.
And well, darn it.
Probably the person on the other end of the line at 2 a.m. would, you know, not have any idea what you were talking about. So we ourselves need to learn to feel comfortable with rapid ethical decision making in the ED. And there's a simple framework that I'm going to share with you that is really simple to learn and apply. And let me give credit where credit is due. It was created by Dr. Kenneth Eisterson, who is a well-known emergency physician bioethicist. So what Dr. Eisterson says is that when you encounter an ethical dilemma in the ED that requires really rapid decision-making, he suggests that you first ask yourself, hey, have I ever encountered that scenario in the past or even a very similar scenario? If you have, and there was a clear way to act that you remember, then you should follow a similar set of actions. So again, you build upon that kind of case-based reasoning to act similarly when you encounter something that feels or sounds a lot like what you had in the past. If that's not the case, and this seems like something that's pretty new and it's pretty challenging in terms of a dilemma, you can quickly ask yourself 3 questions.
1,
would I be willing to have my physician act in this manner if I were in this patient's place? And so that really kind of has you step into the patient's shoes and think about, what if the converse were true and I was having somebody decide something about me?
2,
would I be comfortable if all clinicians with my background and in these same circumstances acted in this manner? So that's where you're kind of getting the generalizability to your scenario, and you're, you know, putting it out there that you're not just a sole actor. What would groupthink be like? What would multiple clinicians do with that same background and these same circumstances?
3.
Finally, this is the part about transparency that I really like. The 3rd question is, am I ready to state openly to my peers, superiors, or to the public the reason for my proposed action? So this isn't something I'm doing in secret. This is something I'm ready to defend and I'm ready to stand behind that has good ethical grounding. And if you can say yes to all of those questions based on the action you proposed, you are on good, solid ethical ground for your actions.
That is such a great 1-2-3 punch to help guide your rapid medical decision making surrounding ethical dilemmas. And actually, it's a great framework for deciding on anything that's tough in the ED. You know, should I get TPA right now? Should I restrain this person? Oh, so many good uses for it. I'm going to put it in my back pocket.
The key element here, I think, is the time sensitivity. And, you know, we all need help in making rapid time pressure decisions. And I agree with you. This is a great framework to do so.
Perfect.
Summary.
Well, hey, let's wrap things up. And I always like to leave this last bit to give the listeners a few key learning points or next steps for them to work on. And maybe you can help bring it home for us.
You bet. So I think the most common question that I hear in the ED when ethical issues arise is, what does the law say? And even though that's actually the wrong question, it's human nature to think about the legality of our actions.
Absolutely.
Because we're kind of scared about the ramifications. But what I'd like us to do instead is focus on more patient-centered, value-driven decisions, because that is what is really all about that impact, that humanistic impact you can make on patient care. Now, I'm going to tell you that knowledge of the law regarding common practice situations is absolutely necessary and important. You shouldn't disregard that at all, because sometimes the line between the law and ethics is blurred. Now, you should remember that bioethics responds very rapidly to a changing healthcare environment, whereas the law might remain silent, inconsistent, or even morally wrong on matters that are vitally important to the biomedical community, just because it takes a lot longer to solve things through cases. And I think the greatest example of that are all the landmark right to die cases that went through the court system over decades before we were really able to come to some kind of conclusion. And even those differ on a state-by-state basis. So I think, you know, really remaining patient-centered and value-driven and considering the law, but not taking it as the only thing driving your actions is very, very important. So I'll sum that up in a statement. Good ethics often makes good law, but good law does not necessarily make good ethics.
Wow.
So another, I think, take-home point is, when time is not a critical factor, you should draw upon your case-based learning and, you know what, review some of your crisis decisions with colleagues and ethicists to refine your skills. These are great opportunities to do in a setting if you're doing a quality review or an M&M. Use an ethical lens in addition to a clinical lens to kind of go through how you made the decision you did and what were the outcomes and what could you have done differently. And so the more you practice rapid ethical decision-making in the ED, the more comfortable you will become with it. So remember, emergency decisions are not removed from ethical evaluation just because they are emergency decisions.
Preach. Wow. Emergency decisions are not removed from ethical evaluation just because they are emergency decisions. That is fabulous. And I love that you also bring into the fact that we should all learn from our colleagues' really ethically challenging cases, perhaps in case conference or M&M, because I find the best way to learn is from other people's mistakes and not your own. So thanks for really laying down some amazing practical pearls. And that's a wrap on the Lynn Sessions for today with Dr. Jill Barron. Learn it now, use it tomorrow. We deal and skirt around ethical dilemmas all the time, and now we have some extra tools and language in our armamentarium to help face it head on and more confidently. Thanks so much, Jill.
Thank you, Michelle.
Medical.